again, and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 228. This is the weekly podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community as we discuss the vital topics of saving our domestic flower farms and supporting a floral industry that relies on a safe, seasonal, and local supply of flowers and foliage. This podcast is brought to you by slowflowers.com, the free nationwide online directory to florists, shops, and studios who design with American-grown flowers, and to the farms that grow those blooms. It's the conscious choice for buying and sending flowers. Well, we've made it through the first week of 2016, and I wonder if you've been seeing those social media promises like the one that reads 78 days till spring, or whatever the number happens to be at the countdown point. The new year causes us to take a deep breath and consider what is essential for our life, our purpose, our creative endeavors. At least that's how it's always been for me. Whether that means taking a baby step or making a radical change, we tend to measure our future choices on or around the first of the new year. It's universal. Setting goals and striving to achieve them is what makes us human. I'm excited for 2016 and what it promises in our community, with so many exciting Slow Flowers-inspired gatherings, events, stories, and connections on the horizon. Before I introduce you to this week's featured guest, I have some newsy items to share and a short mini-interview. First off, the huge news that Martha Stewart Living is featuring Slow Flowers and the slowflowers.com directory in its February 2016 issue, aka the Valentine's Day issue. I knew this was in the works, but having come from the media world, I also know firsthand how risky it is to promise that a story will see the light of day, only to find out that it gets dropped at the last minute. So I've had to keep quiet. So the news that this was a reality arrived last week when my photographer friend Lori Black sent this text. Congratulations on your plug in Martha. Page 6, out and about. Fab plug. You're one hot chica. She texted me a photo of the short story, which is so short that I can read it to you in case you haven't seen it yet. Here it goes. The benefits of choosing locally grown foods over those from all over the world extends to flowers as well. That's why Garden and Features editor Melissa Ozawa likes slowflowers.com, an online directory of more than 600 florists and flower farms across the United States. The site offers local blooms in season, for instance, winter tulips or anemones if you're in the Northwest. Have your heart set on classic roses? It also helps users find growers in California and Oregon that ship nationally. There you have it, short and very sweet. Individually, none of us could have earned this type of media attention from a magazine with paid circulation of more than 2 million subscribers, monthly newsstand sales of 115,000 issues, and total audience reach of more than 9 million. The demographics of the Martha Stewart Reader are in close alignment with your own floral business. You can find the reader statistics on my show notes at deborahprinzing.com, so check them out and feel proud of what we've accomplished. And here's another mind-boggling fact. If we tried to purchase the 1/6-page space as an advertisement for slowflowers.com in this issue, it would cost approximately $45,000. Simply put, those 82 words mean so much to our Slow Flowers community and also represent the incredible value you get and gain as a member of slowflowers.com. We can only pursue this type of media coverage if you join the site and support it financially. So keep in mind as you plan your own business marketing budget in the coming year. For just $200 a year, you can have a significant impact in the success of the Slow Flowers movement, and it will directly relate to your business success as well. When I hear from editors who ask for flower farming and floral design images, I often send a call for submissions to members of slowflowers.com. Recently, that paid off in an article by an Associated Press features writer named Sarah Wolf, who wrote about succulents in bridal bouquets. The work of several Slow Flowers members was featured in AP Wire stories that ran in countless daily newspapers across the country, including Holly Chapel of Holly Chapel Floral Design, Kelly Sullivan of Botanique, and Erica Knowles of Botany 101. If you missed the story, you can find a link at deborahprinzing.com. To illustrate its slowflowers.com piece, Martha Stewart Living's art directors reviewed a gallery of choices, including floral images submitted by several Slow Flowers members who responded to my call for artwork. I was asking people to submit Valentine's Day arrangements that represented local flowers. The editors were drawn to a beautiful early spring bouquet from Erica's Fresh Flowers in Warrenton, Oregon. Erica's is owned by Kathleen Barber, a gifted flower farmer, floral designer, and photographer. All her talents came together for this image, which you can see on my show notes at deborahprinzing.com. I caught up with Kathleen by phone last weekend to congratulate her and to record a quick conversation to share with you.
Well, hello. I'm on the line this morning with Kathleen Barber of Erica's Fresh Flowers in Warrenton, Oregon. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello, Deborah.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am great. And we got a nice surprise this week, didn't we?
Oh, yeah. It was great.
So to bring everybody up to speed, and I think I mentioned this in the intro, the piece is long-awaited piece about Slow Flowers and that Martha Stewart Living editors told me they were going to run in the February issue hit the newsstands early because I think subscribers to the magazine already have received the February issue. And there on page 6 is an item about Slow Flowers being a great alternative for local flowers at Valentine's Day. Great piece, not that long, but there's a beautiful floral photo accompanying it, and I kept looking at it and trying to figure out whose it was, and then in the credits it says Kathleen Barber, and I contacted you to see if this was indeed your photo. And you said, yes, it's my photo and my flowers and my design, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So we kind of reconstructed the situation, right?
Yes.
Well, Kathleen, you're not bragging on yourself very much, so I'm going to brag on you. You grew these beautiful flowers. It was a combination of, I think there's like a ranunculus and anemones, and were there little irises in there, the yellow stems?
Dutch iris and some poppies and spirea.
Oh, yeah, the white?
Yeah.
Is that the spirea? Oh, my gosh, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Tell me about this arrangement. When have you created it?
Well, and there's some hosta in there too. Mm. It's just a beautiful springtime collection of flowers, and with the oranges and the salmon and the yellow, I think it's just very eye catching. It was just something unusual, and yeah, those were bouquets that I was making to take to the grocery store, the Astoria Co-op. And, I just decided to take some pictures of them.
Yeah, you're right, because then when I sent out the email in October saying to people in Slow Flowers, hey, whoever has Valentine's Day type bouquets that show local flowers, send them along. You sent this one to me, and it was so unpredictably beautiful because there was no red. And no pink,
right.
And it was very springy, and I love that. Maybe that's why the editors picked it up.
It must be. I mean, I love it, so hopefully other people love it.
So your business is, of course, you're kind of like an early adopter in the local flower scene because your business is over 10 years old, right?
Right. I started in 2005.
And Warrenton is sort of northwest of Portland, is that correct?
Yes, we are just like right on the mouth of the Columbia River before you can, go into the ocean.
Oh, my goodness. So it's you're not rural, but is it more like a suburban area? Or where's your market? You said Astoria is one of your markets.
Right. It's Warrenton is actually pretty big land-wise. And then, of course, we have the bigger city, Astoria, to our north and the seaside to our south.
Mm-hmm. You're coastal then?
Yes.
Okay. And so your business had just started kind of in a family way. I mean, I was rereading the article this morning. Your mother started growing cut flowers and somehow you and your daughter got involved in the business?
My mother she has always grown a big, huge flower garden. She had a flower stand for for years. She started, oh my gosh, I can't even recall, my brother's 50-something, and she started when he was a baby.
Oh, wow.
So people just, you know, have always known that, you know, there were some gorgeous flowers in Warrenton. She always sold out. She just, you know, that was what she just loved doing. And then my daughter kind of took over when she was in high school for my mom, who wanted to retire.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Your daughter's name is?
Erica.
And that's somehow how the business got named. It really wasn't named before that, right?
Right, right.
That's funny.
Yeah, so... And then, of course, she did it for a few years before she went off to college. And then I just decided that I was going to, you know, I just love flowers myself. I was kind of retiring from my day job to stay home with my kids. And it was just kind of grew from there.
Wow. So what kind of, are you growing on the same land that your mom was growing? Or is it a different, you know, cutting garden area?
Yeah, I have... different property in Warrenton at my house.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom still grows a lot of flowers. I post on my Instagram when I go over and steal a bunch of her flowers. I always have like the best collection of stuff, you know. Oh my gosh.
So she's sort of your, she's your secret sauce. You're still cutting at her garden.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She's got a huge, huge garden still that she, yeah, I don't know how she manages to do it.
Well, it's interesting because you're kind of doing the best of both worlds, whereas you're doing these highly diversified seasonal bouquets for, I guess, the roadside stand, but you're also, you must have enough quantities to do these bouquets for the for a supermarket customer. You said the Astoria Co-op, so that's like a regular supply that you have to come up with every week, right?
Well, during the growing season, you know, when I have a lot of extra flowers, yeah, I will take them to the co-op or Three Cups Coffee House. You know, I have different avenues or different outlets that I take,
mm-hmm.
take my flowers to. But really what I love doing is just designing big, beautiful art pieces and taking pictures of them, taking my flowers down to the beach and taking pictures of them, or out in the woods and taking pictures.
And that's what people are able to, if they follow you on Instagram, that's the kind of sort of beautiful, composed settings that you're starting to, that's appearing at every photo you take has got some little story behind it, right?
Right. I do it more like an art piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I do business accounts where, you know, I can do like a more like a floral installation of, you know, something that is very unique that other, I mean, people don't see anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I get a lot of feedback from my businesses that I take stuff to that, you know, everybody, their customers are intrigued because they've never seen textures and flowers and, you know, whatever else I put in
bits
the arrangement.
Bits of nature, things from the beach probably too, right?
Yeah, there can be some things from the beach in there.
So
yeah.
I will show, just for our listeners to meet you, if they don't know you already, I'll try to share all your social media channels so people can follow you, and also your website. And you have intentionally separated your floral business from your photography business now. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So what's your photography business called?
Kathleen Barber Photography.
Okay. And you're doing lots of floral photography, but also local sort of...
Portrait, family photography. Right. And the website is KathleenBarberPhoto.com.
Okay. Oh, good. Well, I'll share that link too. But how perfect that this moment in time is in this tiny photo that is maybe 1 1/4 inches square in Martha Stewart Living, which is so beautiful, captures what you've grown and what you've arranged and what you photographed. It's sort of, that's the direction your business is going and your profession in terms of these two channels that are kind of complementary.
Exactly. There's just, you know, I'm so much I put into each arrangement, and it just like, you know, I know it takes a lot to, like, compose the photo, but I try to make sure I get at least something, you know, a nice photo of, you know, everything I construct before it goes off to the customer.
You know what? That is brilliant. I hear from so many designers who say, we were so rushed before the wedding. When we had to do the delivery, we only got a crappy iPhone photo of this entire, you know, beautiful arrangement. And that's, I guess that's fine if you think that the photographer will ultimately share things with you. But I hear people often have to wait 6 months to get those photos.
Right. Now, if you can invest in a nice camera and learn how to use it and everything else that goes on in photography.
Plan ahead, have a little time.
Have a nice staging area and a studio.
Yeah.
And that's what I ended up creating for myself.
Oh, that's cool. So Valentine's Day is obviously right around the corner in our minds of the floral calendar. What will you do at Valentine's Day, you know, with what is available from, you know, your garden or your, do you have hoop houses or high tunnels, or are you mainly growing in or field grown flowers?
Well, I have two hoop houses, 20 by 60 feet, and I'm still waiting, you know, the weather's so unpredictable.
Yeah, it's
right
winter.
Now it's just gorgeous outside. But,
oh, it is? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It is, but what's the temperature like?
Oh, it's probably about 40, 45.
Wow. It's mild, really mild.
Yeah, it's,
wow.
It makes you, it's like spring is like right, but I know it's not. So Valentine's Day, I want to do some more jewelry like I did last year. People seem to really like that.
Some floral jewelry?
Yes.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure yet what, you know, floral crowns. I want to do something that's, you know, unique and probably some, you know, arrangements with, of course, locally grown flowers, whatever I can get my hands on at the time.
Because basically you're designing to order for specific customers because you don't have a retail outlet. Is that correct?
Right, right.
Yeah. But I guess what I'm hearing is that because of your mild winter, although who knows, it could always get colder, but you will have a lot of things to cut in your high tunnels. I don't know, will you have ranunculus and anemones, or is that a little too early, or will it be more like spring bulbs?
Well, I got a little late start on that. I kind of plan more for Mother's Day also, because right now, of course, everybody's trying to get their seed orders in, order bulbs for summer. It's kind of a busy time.
It's a scramble, yeah. Things that, yeah, you told me you were planting ranunculus yesterday when I started
this up. Yes, right. Lots of ranunculus to plant.
Well, I think even just giving people the notion that there are other choices at Valentine's Day that can come from a local flower farmer or a florist who works with local flower farmers, rather than sort of the ubiquitous, you know, one dozen long-stem red roses for South America. Just having Martha Stewart give a little mention to this idea to perhaps shift people's thinking is going to it's going to have great results for people like you and all the other people in our community who are trying to, you know, take advantage of a big floral holiday when they're having to compete with imports.
Oh, definitely. And I really think that, you know, now's the time to reach out to your flower farmers and see, you know, what they're going to have available. And, you know, try, you know, put your order in and stress, you know, the importance of, you know, locally grown flowers and how, you know, beautiful they are and how much, you know, they're safe to touch.
Right. You know, they didn't have to travel far.
And they didn't have to travel far, yeah.
So. And that you're obviously a small business in your own community, and that I think there's some valid appeal for people who want to keep their dollars in Warrington or in Astoria or Seaside. They know you're local, and that's part of the specialness of what you do.
Yeah, I mean, and some of the flowers that you can grow, you know, as a flower farmer, they've never seen. Or, you know, I have people, you know, at the coffee shop, I can watch them, you know, when I have bouquets of ranunculus, and they're staring at them, and they ask the girls there, are they real? They don't know. They, you know, they've never seen, you know, those type of flowers. It's kind of interesting to watch.
They're bursting with pride. Oh, I love it. Well, listen, I'm hoping to get down to visit you. I'm so close by in Seattle. There's no excuse for me not to come down and see your farm sometime this summer. So this is going to be my challenge to myself to take it. I bet I could do it in a day, a long day. but I just was delighted when I finally went back into my files, saw that you had sent me that photo that had been in the gallery of choices that I sent to Martha Stewart, because they never confirmed with me whose photo they were going to use. So this was a big surprise when I opened the magazine. For those of you listening, the February issue of Martha Stewart hit the newsstands on January 11th, and subscribers received it about a week earlier. So February is alive and well, easy for you to grab. Look on page 6 and share it with your friends and family and clients, and especially your clients, and let them know you're part of this movement and that you're a resource for them when they need to buy flowers. And Kathleen, I'm just so pleased that you made this look so beautiful and tickled the fancy of the biggest, you know, magazine in our community with 2 million circulation, by the way. So a lot of people are going to see that photo.
Well, thank you so much for submitting it for me.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Okay, well, listen, I'm really glad I got to grab you for this quick hello and congratulations, and just to introduce you to people who maybe don't know you yet. Now they can start following you and be inspired by the photos that you're posting and the flowers that you're growing.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If the image you submitted for consideration for the Martha story wasn't chosen, don't feel disappointed. I've been asked to share images with another prominent publication for a pre-Valentine's Day web gallery coming up soon, and you can be sure your floral submissions will be included. I'll share details once they're published. Next up, Amy McGee of the blog Botanical Brouhaha hosted a guest post from me last week in which I shared the slow flower story. You can find the link to that blog post at deborahprinzing.com. I'm so appreciative that Amy dedicated her time and her valuable online space on that popular floral blog to share the slowflowers.com story with her readers. One lucky reader won our giveaway of a 1-year premium listing to promote her floral business on slowflowers.com. Congratulations to Eden Fry of the Garden of Eden Floral Design. I'm so pleased that visitors to slowflowers.com will soon discover this Idaho-based floral design business that also serves the Spokane, Washington area. Okay, it's time to introduce you to Quill Teal Sullivan, our featured guest today. Quill is a horticulturist, flower farmer, and floral designer, and she's the garden manager of Meadowburn Farm, a historic New Jersey garden and working farm located in the Warwick and Verdon Valley area, just 90 minutes from New York City. There, she is leading preservation efforts and saving the century-old picking garden and heirloom floral varieties once grown by the original owner, Helena Rutherford Ely, and she lived between 1858 and 1920. Helena was a pioneering figure in American horticulture at the turn of the 20th century and a founding member of the Garden Club of America. Quill has worked with the owners of Meadowburn Farm for the past 6 years to preserve their significant historic gardens, which are listed on the National Register of Historic Places and sit at the center of Meadowburn's 590-acre preserved farm. As a graduate student in the Longwood Graduate Program, Quill spent 2 years researching the garden's history and possibilities for their preservation, which served as the topic of her master's thesis. Today, she acts, as I said, as the garden manager, working day in and day out to bring the 130-year-old gardens back to life. Here's a little bit more about Meadowburn from their beautiful website. Helena Rutherford Ely built her gardens surrounding her country home, Meadowburn, over the course of a 40-year period with the help of her loyal gardener, Albert Furman. Through trial and error, she developed the practical, hands-on horticulture knowledge that informed and inspired her 3 widely influential books on hardy gardening. In her day, Helena was considered one of the premier garden experts in America, and her gardens at Meadowburn were recognized as among the finest in the country. The process of rehabilitating the gardens that Helena Ely designed, interpreting her vision and philosophy, and tending the landscape day to day, is a deeply rewarding and very personal journey for Quill, who has been gardening since she was a girl, helping in her mother's garden in the Pacific Northwest. In bringing Helena's story and the important historic gardens at Meadowburn back to life, Quill has begun to find her own voice as a horticulturist. Her work has been featured in Martha Stewart Living, on my friend Ken Drews' podcast Real Dirt, and on Green Wedding Shoes blog. I first met Quill 2 years ago. We started an email correspondence after she made a contribution to the slowflowers.com Indiegogo campaign, and she replied to my thank you note with this email. I just saw that you are based in Seattle, which is where I will be for another week and a half before making the trek back east to wake up the gardens at Meadowburn Farm. If you have any free time in the next week, I would love to take you out to coffee and talk about my project at Meadowburn and perhaps get your advice. In a nutshell, I am managing the restoration of a 6-acre historic garden outside of New York City and working with the family to set up a business which hopefully will incorporate cut flowers. For 100 years, the garden had a 1-acre picking garden which filled the house with fresh cut flowers from May until frost. We still have over 500 linear feet of heirloom peonies and hundreds of heirloom dahlias. Can you just imagine that she got me at that sentence? And then Quill continued, I have done quite a bit of research on the possibility of selling our cuts, and I've spoken with several other growers, such as the folks at Jell-O Mold Farm. Would you be willing to meet with me? I'd be so grateful. Well, that turned out to be a lovely moment in the midst of my busy Indiegogo campaign when Quill and I met at my neighborhood bakery. She shared the fascinating story of her own journey into horticulture and tempted me with tales of a once famed but nearly forgotten American garden writer whose historic gardens were coming back to life in Quill's own hands. In retrospect, I realized what an opportunity I missed to share her story then with our larger community, and mainly that's because it was months before we launched this podcast. So now I'm making up for that oversight. And while Quill was back in Seattle over the holidays, we sat down to record this interview. Consider this our delayed by 2 years do-over, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, and I am delighted to welcome Quill Teal Sullivan as my guest today. Hi, Quill.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. And, in the intro, I described how we've met, and so here it is, I guess, January in Seattle. And you're back, and so that seems to be when we connect. We did that 2 years ago,
yeah,
right?
That's right, yeah.
Quill is the garden manager at Meadowburn Farm in New Jersey. It has an amazing horticulture history, and we're going to hear a lot about that today. And there's a cut flower component, so that's sort of what connected us.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start about your horticulture education, because you're a Seattle native. How did you end up at Longwood Gardens graduate program, and what was that path to get you sort of pursuing a professional career in horticulture?
Yeah, let's see. I've always loved to garden. And in college, my undergraduate education, I was kind of pursuing botany.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go?
I was at Colorado College.
Okay.
In Colorado Springs. And I found that botany was the best place to kind of squeak my interest into. So I did botany and plant science, plant physiology, and it was fascinating. I learned a lot. In the end, it was, I'm not a scientist. Mm-hmm. I appreciate design and space and arts, and I'm hands-on.
Yeah.
And so after college, and during college, I did a few internships in public gardens. I went to the Mendocino Coast Botanic Garden for a summer, which was amazing.
Oh, neat.
And then after college, I was at Filoli outside of San Francisco, which is a historic garden there.
Yes, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a great experience. That was really my first introduction to gardening in a historic context. And the way at the time that Filoli operated, they followed very kind of strict practices, mm-hmm. And they interpreted the historic design and horticultural practices very rigidly.
Is this sort of what happens at public gardens that are associated with maybe a historic estate, where you use old plans and old records and
old, you know, planting sketches? I mean, you go to the documents, the original documents, for your inspiration?
Yeah, I think it varies, okay, depending on kind of the vision that the garden has at the present time and really who's directing it. And when I was there, it was very much everything that was done, the plants that were selected. Even sometimes I felt like the tools, actually, absolutely, the tools that were used were selected based on the history and what was common at the time that the gardens were built. And it just raised a lot of questions for me about how you preserve a living, growing landscape. And at Filoli, there was a lot of challenges because they were so strict about how they did things. There were just things that didn't really work anymore. And so there was a lot of, like, struggle to figure out how to, you know, keep this tree growing in a certain way, in a certain microclimate. So that really piqued my interest in historic horticulture. And I kind of was distracted by a brief stint in baking.
Oh, right, I remember hearing about this. That's why you can get up early in the morning, right?
Yes, yeah, do my best work in the morning. And after spending a couple years baking and by a hot oven and spending the best part of the day sleeping, I really was itching to get back into the garden. So that's when I went and was the gardener at the Dunn Historic Garden Trust.
Here in Seattle.
And that was a wonderful experience.
So did you work with Glenn and Charles closely in the gardens?
Yep. Wow. Yep. They were my bosses.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And the E.B. Dunn Historic Garden Trust is a Olmsted property in North Seattle that is just exquisite and beautiful. And I'll put a link on our show notes
so people
can check it out because it's open to the public.
It has
a membership, vibrant membership.
Oh, beautiful woodland garden. Oh.
I forgot you spent time there.
Yeah.
So that was, when was that?
That was the year before I went off to Longwood.
Okay.
And so during that time, when they hired me, I said, just to let you know, this is my hope. I'm applying to this program and the odds are terrible, so I'll probably end up being here for another 5 years. And so I left Dunn because I had been accepted to Longwood. And I didn't know anything about Longwood Gardens, which is shocking for people on the East Coast.
Right, but you just heard that they had a good graduate program in horticulture, right?
You know, I didn't really know about the program either. I had started looking at Cornell for horticulture because they have a fantastic horticulture program there. So I was looking at a graduate school opportunity there, and they had a sister program, which I believe doesn't exist anymore. But very similar to Longwood. It was kind of modeled after the Longwood program. It was very new. It was about 3 years old. And so through that, I actually discovered Longwood because a lot of the students that apply for Longwood were also applying to the Cornell program.
Okay.
And so I was like, oh, what's this Longwood everyone's talking about? And I went to the website, and it's just a really stellar program and fit exactly my interests. I had no idea I could get a master's in public horticulture.
Wow.
So it was really just searching the internet until I found the right thing. And I was just ecstatic.
Was that a two-year program?
It's a two-year program.
Okay, wow.
And it's thesis-driven, and the students can really select what they want to pursue, and then all of your coursework you can kind of tailor to what your thesis topic is. So I applied knowing that I wanted to study historic garden preservation.
But you didn't have like a darling garden in mind to build your research around.
No,
and
I had no idea.
You just kind of let Kismet take care of that, right?
Yep. Yeah.
How far into the program did you hook up with the owners of Meadowburn then?
My first few months there, actually, I had to decide on my thesis topic before the end of that first semester.
Okay.
And I had met Bill Noble, the director of preservation at the Garden Conservancy, at a historic landscape conference, and had had a couple conversations with him. And when I returned to from the conference, I reached out to him to see if he had any ideas of thesis topics in the field. And I really wanted a topic that was felt meaningful to more than just myself, and I didn't want to write a thesis that was just going to sit on a shelf and be forgotten. I wanted something that could really sustain my interest for 2 years. And he had been contacted by the owner of Meadowburn at the time, Mr. Coster Gerard, who actually passed away a few years ago, pretty shortly after I met him. But he knew his garden was important, and was wondering what should be done with it, whether it should be kind of put to bed or revived. And so Bill put us together, and he said, this is one opportunity for a thesis project if you wanted to do like a site-based research project, which versus something that was more theoretical, having a place that I could connect 2 years of research and study to seemed like the perfect thing.
Oh my gosh, that just gives me the shivers. I mean, that is a rare, I mean, I guess at the time you even knew that it was rare to be handed sort of a undeveloped historical property, something that needed to be rediscovered.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's phenomenal. So tell people, tell the listeners where Meadowburn is and, you know, how it fits in the East Coast sort of Great Gardens storyline, and how did you approach this whole project? Because 2 years is a big chunk of your life.
Yeah, so Meadowburn is located directly on the border of New York and New Jersey, about an hour due west of the city. It's actually at the tail end of the Hudson Valley. On the New York side, there's a little town called Warwick, and on the New Jersey side is a little town called Vernon. It's a beautiful, beautiful area, and very pastoral. We kind of, when you're in Meadowburn, it's a 600-acre historic dairy farm. The garden itself is 6 acres surrounding the historic estate house, and that's on the National Register. And the heart, the domestic heart of the property, that 6-acre garden, is in the middle of the 600 acres.
Wow.
So when you're in the garden, you just look out onto rolling hills and small mountains, and you could just be in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
And actually, an hour outside of New York City is pretty convenient, too, for lots of reasons.
Oh, it's profound to think about that kind of space never getting subdivided, never been turned into commuter, home tracks or anything like that. So
yeah.
There's always been this caretaker kind of shepherding of, people caring about this property, right?
Yep. There's been, it's been owned by 3 families each for about 100+ years.
And they've all been super invested in keeping that land intact and not subdividing it or anything.
Yeah. The exact acreage has kind of fluctuated over the years, and now it's actually the agricultural land is all preserved.
Okay. And that's and being on the historic register also has some preservation quality to it, does it? Or
It doesn't. It doesn't mean that the next owner couldn't bulldoze it if they wanted to or put a swimming pool in.
Uh-huh.
It's more a designation of significance, and I think from that point you can then apply for other sorts of designations, or it just kind of gives it some clout as a historic property.
Why did it appeal to you?
Well, the first thing that piqued my interest was that it was designed by a woman. There was very little information about the garden and about Helena Rutherford Ely, the woman who had created it. But the fact that it was designed by a woman was the first thing that interested me.
Yeah.
And the little bit of information that was out there was a bio on the Cultural Landscape Foundation's website, and it described her as a pioneer in the field of horticulture, and she kind of helped transition home gardening from the Victorian style of annual bedding out to the more hardy gardening style, something that was already kind of taking ground in England with William Robinson, but hadn't really hit home gardens yet in the States. And she was a She was a self-taught gardener. She was a dirt gardener, so she had her hands in the ground. She was very well off, but she designed the whole landscape on her own. She didn't hire a landscape architect. And she was out there in the garden every day.
Wow.
And so I was inspired by that story, and I wanted to learn more.
Wow. So Helena Rutherford Ely was, I remember reading in something that you, a link you had sent me, that this was her country home, so she was of means. What, from New York City or Philadelphia, or where was her family based?
New York City.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So she had descended from various old colonial New York and New Jersey families.
Mm-hmm. And yet something about being in the country at her country house, which of course you described as an estate, connected her with the land, and it really shaped her professional profile, because she became a writer about gardens, right?
That's right. Yeah. So at the time that she started building the gardens in 1880, there weren't a lot of resources available for beginning gardeners, novice gardeners, especially written by women. There were books on garden design and garden ornamentation, but not practical horticulture books. And so she was really self-taught, like I said, and learned a lot through experimentation and trial and error. And her friends started looking to her for advice. And so she'd write long letters about what she was doing and how they could do it. And eventually she was encouraged to put it into a small book.
How cool.
And that was called A Woman's Hardy Garden, and it was published in 1903. And there was such a need for that sort of resource that it became a bestseller and was printed multiple times in the first year, and really made her and her garden very famous.
Wow. And so Meadowburn then was developed, as you said, in the late 1800s. And for how many years was Helena gardening there?
She gardened there very actively until 1917. Her husband passed away in 1914, and she remarried a man with a large wild garden in Connecticut. And so she actually passed away in 1920. So for the last 3 years of her life, she was establishing a new garden up in Connecticut, which no longer exists.
Oh my
tragically.
Goodness. So this is even more important that her work can be embodied in what you're doing at Meadowburn then.
Yeah, it's really the only example of Ely's work. She had designed small gardens for other friends, but there's not enough information out there to know where they were, if they exist. I should say that another thing that makes Ely very important is that she was one of the founding members of the Garden Club of America and was the first vice president. So that's another way in which she was influential.
That's so cool. And so when you started your thesis, you were invited by the family, that the current owners, they probably didn't know where to start. Did they give you some access to the historic records, and did you walk the grounds? I mean, how did you shape what your research was going to be?
I documented. I went up and visited about once a month for 2 years and photographed. The family had pictures of the gardens from their time there and some historic images and also some documents, little histories that had been written about Helena or Meadowburn over the years. So they were very forthcoming with all the information they had and very helpful.
Archival stuff.
Yeah. But there's really not a lot out there. Really what I started looking to was her three books. Read each one about 25 times.
Oh my goodness.
And then trying to find archives and libraries, anything that related to Helena, her family, or the property, or the area. So just finding whatever I could and researching online to find mentions of Meadowburn or the books from, you know, Google's amazing these days. All these old articles, old New York Times articles are now digitized. So that was a fantastic resource. Reaching out to Helena's existing family, I found her grandson's name and probably about 5 addresses for him, and I wrote letters and I sent them to all the addresses, and probably 2 months later our graduate office got a phone call from him, And I just, it blew my mind that, first of all, that I had found him and that he reached out to me.
Yes.
And he has become a very dear friend and was very supportive of my research and my hope for the garden. And so his family then had tons of historic photographs.
That's the mother load.
Yeah. That was the mother load. That was amazing. And to have met him, to then have his support and encouragement, and then also the access to his family archives was really a huge gem.
It must have been so meaningful for them to have you come along, this, you know, 21st century woman gardener, mm-hmm. who wanted to revive that story and really honor it. And I can just see how this stuff is seeing the light of day that they had probably had in the attic somewhere, and you cared about it.
Yeah.
That's exciting. You've got a big smile on your face. I do. So you wrote your thesis, and what was the actual title of it, or just, is that how people handle theses? I don't know.
Yeah, the title is Rediscovering the Story. No. What is it? Oh, it's a preservation proposal for the gardens of Helena Rutherford Ely at Meadowburn Farm.
Okay, so it was really your analysis of how this garden could be preserved then?
Yes.
For what? For people to visit or for people to study at or all
both.
Of the above?
Both. I mean, hopefully both. And so I had three questions. The first was, what is the significance of the garden and is it significant? And at the time when I started, it wasn't clear that it was a significant garden worth saving. And if it wasn't significant, maybe restoring or rehabilitating the garden wasn't the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Maybe it would be documenting it as best as possible. So that was the first question that really steered the rest of the thesis. The second question was, is preservation feasible? So that looks at who owns the property, what's the community like, is there interest, would there be interest and support from the local community, are there neighbors, could you support visitor parking, that sort of stuff. And then the third question was, what are existing models that could be applied, models for preservation? So that looks at, you know, nonprofit models, partnerships,
sure.
conservation easements, mm-hmm. and where revenue might come from. Mm-hmm. Because in addition to preserving and reviving the gardens, the hope from the family is really that by doing that, they can help self-sustain financially.
And it sounds like you found answers to all those questions in your research. And the first one was, is it significant, right?
Yes, yeah.
That's pretty profound.
Yeah, and I am a believer that it's very significant. And as an example of a garden, at that time in history when, you know, it is the golden age of American gardens, and there's a lot of families buying, creating vast estates in the Hudson Valley that are very grand, a lot of hardscape, Italianate, landscape architects and huge teams of gardeners. And Meadowburn is at a very like personal scale. You can almost tell that it was designed by someone that didn't have a degree in landscape architecture, and it was it feels as though the person who created it had such an intimate understanding mm-hmm. of the landscape and had a vision. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that she was self-taught, had this very strong vision, and was also kind of forging her way in this kind of, there's definitely like undertones of feminism here, because she's out gardening and talking about manure at dinner parties in groups of people who look down upon it and think that she should be embroidering and singing in the parlor. And she,
I love it. I want to see a film about her.
Yeah, I know. It would be so cool. So she was a mover and a shaker, and the Meadowburn very much, to me, represents that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Anything about Meadowburn itself, where that name came from? Have you been able to determine that? What
yeah,
does that mean?
Meadowburn came, so her ancestry is Scottish, and I guess burn refers to a river, and there's this, the Wauwillonda River snakes through the property, and she gave the name Meadowburn. I think it was maybe one of her aunts had started calling it Meadowburn, but it has its roots in their Scottish ancestry.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah. It's beautiful. Okay, so here you are. You're doing this research. You're spending a lot of time trying to determine, you know, the future of this place. And you finish your master's thesis, and then you end up becoming the garden manager there. So obviously that you evolved along with this property, and the owners wanted to keep you involved. Is that what happened? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I presented my findings to the family and gave them recommendations, which was pretty much, your garden is very significant. It's worth saving. There's interest. There'd be interest from the local community and the garden history community. And then here are some ideas of how you can do it. So you could do a small business, or we could start a small nonprofit. And it was, if I wasn't there to make it happen, it probably wouldn't have happened. So I think they recognized that and hired me to see it through. And what they had wanted was, you know, it's still a private residence, that their mother still resides there in the summers. So they weren't ready to create a nonprofit and hand it all over to a board. And so they still wanted it to be their family home.
Sure.
And so what we did then was start a small business to oversee the operations
of
the garden.
So is it considered a nonprofit business or a for-profit business then?
It's for-profit, okay. Mm-hmm. And at present we don't make any profit, so it's a for-profit with no profit.
I think a lot of us know about that. But you're trying to figure out how it can sustain itself with,
yes,
generating income.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So when you got on board, what did you tackle first? Was the property in good shape, or did you have to do some renovation just to get it ready for business?
We had to do a lot of work.
Okay.
And another thing that makes the garden very special is that it has been maintained by three generations of the same gardening family. Helena Rutherford Ely had hired a 17-year-old boy as her assistant, and he was kept on after the property sold in 1930 to the current owners, their great uncle. And so there had been this gardening tradition for 130 years.
Wow.
And in the past 2 to 3 decades, maintenance had been cut back drastically. A lot of the evergreen plant material had been pretty much destroyed by deer, and they were just kind of doing the bare minimum to keep, you know, the lawns cut, and actually our dahlias planted, which is amazing. But when I got there, it was pretty much a ghost garden, very overgrown, broken, but the bones were there. And the magic was there.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I think the first thing I did the first year I was there, I was documenting a lot, looking at what grew, what flowers came up. I didn't want to do anything drastic before I knew exactly what was there in the ground.
Because you maybe didn't know until it came up in the spring or whatever.
Absolutely, I didn't know. And man, just over and over again, every season, I was just blown away by the things that would emerge from the ground. One of the most exciting for me was a tulip called Picotee, and we've identified it as Picotee, which is a cultivar from 1895. Mm. And there, we were able to identify it because we have a Lumiere autochrome of Picotee tulips in the garden from 1910, and Lumiere autochromes are one of the original true forms of color photography, so the color is accurate.
Oh my goodness.
It's not color tinted. And there's this image of one of the gardens just blooming with like hundreds of these pink lily flowered tulips. And I saw it blooming in the garden. I was like, and then, so I was aware that there was a pink tulip in the garden, maybe like 3 blooms every spring. And then I had found this Lumiere autochrome from Ely's grandson. And it just, at one day, I like put 2 and 2 together, and I just got so excited. And I knew where this tulip was, but I hadn't marked it. And I, that fall, I dug up about 4 square feet of ground with a spoon trying to find these tulip bulbs, and I did.
Oh, my goodness.
And actually, the man who was able to identify it was Scott Kuntz from Old House Gardens.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
And he's been a great resource for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, just blew my mind, first of all, that we were able to identify it and that a few tulips still existed, because deer come through and just chow all of those. Squirrels, you know, there's so many things that you could lose these tulip bulbs to. So I dug them up. I made this sweet little mouse-proof cage and replanted them, and actually for the first 2 years grew them in a cage so that they weren't damaged. Sent some to Scott. And that's been, you know, an example of one of the just delightful finds for me.
So you basically had this photograph showing hundreds of them, and they dwindled down to three or a handful of bulbs.
Yeah.
Where are you at now? Have you been able to increase the population of those tulips?
Yeah, I've gone from about the first year I transplanted them, I had one bloom.
Oh, my goodness.
But they naturalize. It's a naturalizing tulip. And so the second year, I had about five. And hopefully next year I'll have more.
That's exciting.
It's exciting. And really what I'd love to do when I have the time is figure out who to work with to actually bring that tulip back to the market.
Right.
Because it's special.
Right. Exactly.
And also it goes from, so when it comes out, emerges as a bud, it's kind of faintly, this like faint, whitish yellow, and as it blooms, it's the first day it has a tiny little pink fringe on the tips, and as it goes through its cycle, every day it gets a little bit pinker, so it actually goes from a pale yellowy white to deep pink.
Wow. Oh, how exciting. Well, I was looking in my old correspondence when I knew we were going to get together to try to find that first email you sent to me. And I did find it, and in that email you talked about the something like, I'm just paraphrasing, 500 linear feet of dahlias in a cutting garden. But you called it a picking garden.
Yes.
So is the picking garden a big part of your research, and was it always a significant part of Helena's garden? Because that's sort of where the cut flower component gets exciting to me.
Absolutely. So the I call it the picking garden because that's what the gardeners call it, and I liked the sound of it.
I do too.
The picking garden was always a huge part of Ely's garden and design, and about half of, maybe a quarter of the cultivated area of those 6 acres was picking gardens.
Wow.
And she would fill her house every day with 75 bouquets of cut flowers.
That's crazy.
She loved cutting flowers. And she would always do single flower arrangement. So there would be like a vase of poppies or a vase of peonies or a vase of phlox. She would never mix.
She really wanted to showcase what she was growing, probably.
Yeah, yeah. And also I think it was, I don't know, I think it was maybe also a trend at the time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But in the picking garden, we still have about 1,000 linear feet of heirloom peonies.
Oh, peonies, that's right, not the dahlias.
We have the dahlias, too. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, about 1,000 feet of linear feet of heirloom peonies, which are very, very fragrant and beautiful. I haven't actually had the time yet to really pinpoint those varieties, figure out exactly what they are. I have ideas.
But can I stop you for a second? Mm-hmm. The thing about that blows my mind is that there was almost 2 decades of deferred maintenance or neglect in this garden.
Yeah.
The peonies didn't really seem to notice.
No, they don't care.
They just are, they're tough.
Peonies, yeah.
Right. I love it. And that now they're getting a little bit more attention from you. There'll be so much to learn from that amazing stand. I mean, I can't even imagine 1,000 linear feet. It was like your own peony farm.
Yeah, it's quite impressive when it blooms.
Cool.
Yeah, and then also the dahlias, which did require a lot of attention. And so we have we've identified 7 cultivars that have been in the garden for since Ely's time.
Wow.
And they remain because the gardeners always really cherished the dahlias. It was probably the original gardener's maybe favorite cut flower. And so every winter they were stored in the basement, and every spring they were replanted. And even in those the last couple decades of very minimal maintenance, the peonies were, or the, I'm sorry, the dahlias were always planted.
So the practice of from gardener down to one gardener to the next was always, we're going to dig these in the fall, store them in the basement, and then replant them in the spring. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thank goodness, right?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And that's really unique that we have these old dahlias, because since they are dug up every winter, there's a lot of risk that you might lose them in a season. And, you know, the basement freezes, or someone goes, a rat eats them all. Who knows?
Oh,
there's
yeah.
a lot of things that, or you just forget to plant them, or don't plant them for some reason. So that was really exciting. And, yeah, I worked with some folks at the American Dahlia Society who got very excited that these heirlooms existed and were really adamant about finding out what they were. And we were able to identify one cultivar to a historic... we're able to identify one variety as a historic cultivar named cultivar, and that's Jane Cowell. And it's this beautiful, informal, decorative dinner plate peach dahlia, which I think is going to be the next Cafe au Lait on the flower market.
And by
stay
the way,
tuned.
You're going to share a photo with me so I can put it on my show
okay,
notes, okay?
Absolutely. Right. I keep saying, move over, Cafe au Lait. Here comes Jane Cowell. It hasn't caught on yet. But
so
I do hear peach is becoming more trendy for weddings.
Absolutely. So that dates back to the turn of the century?
That dates back to 1928.
Okay.
That's the date that it was released.
Okay.
So that post-dates Ely a little bit, actually, by 8 years. But still very exciting.
Yes.
And then the other six varieties, we weren't able to actually pinpoint to a historic named variety. And that's partly because there are so many that existed. A lot of the documentation are in black and white or color tinted, and then there's just not a lot of existing specimens to compare and contrast to. But the man I was working with, the late Steve Nortowski, who is a huge figure in the Dahlia Society, the American Dahlia Society, he really took this on and reached out to colleagues in the UK and all throughout the country, and he helped me identify the characteristics of these dahlias that prove that they're heirlooms. So,
so there was what were some of the other ones?
So we have a peony flower dahlia, which is a form of dahlia bloom that at the turn of the century was very popular, and you don't see around a lot. So the peony flower dahlia has ray florets that. Kind of like a single layer of ray florets, and then the inner ray florets are coiled and curly. We have two of those. There's Old Tweet, which also grows to about 11 feet tall.
Oh, my God.
Which is, you know, also characteristic of an heirloom dahlia. Leggy and kind of kooky. It's fantastic. For anyone who's interested in unusual heirlooms, I think Old Tweet is a variety that will, like, blow a dahlia gardener's mind. And then we have one called Biba, which is, I think it's been called, like, a show or a fancy dahlia. It actually has bobbing blooms. So at first I was frustrated. I wanted the blooms to stand upright, and it would be, you know, better for a bouquet, better for cut flowers. And as I spent more time with the dahlia, I started to really love it, the bobbing blooms that kind of arch into a walkway. And then you see actually the side of the flower, which almost looks like a honeycomb, the pattern of the petals.
So when you're walking through the border, you appreciate it at eye level almost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's maybe why it was bred that way.
Yeah, and it just gives variety to the form of the dahlias in the
wow.
garden. So
now I know that I saw on your website, your beautiful website that I know you were
Thank
involved
you.
In, you have documented these found dahlias
mm-hmm.
and described their provenance and how you've renamed them. But more than that, you're making these available to people. So you have a mail order business, or is it just on site for selling tubers?
It's mail order.
Wow. So now's the time for people to check this out.
Now's the time. Yeah, before they disappear. And that's one of my goals for this time at Meadowburn for me is to really preserve the heirloom cultivars that we have through propagation and distribution. I think that's the only way you can really keep these varieties going, is if other people fall in love with them and want to grow them.
Absolutely.
And want to share them. So
yeah, you can't just keep one patch of these things, right?
Too risky.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is this the second year you've been selling tubers, or?
Second year, third year maybe. I did just a few the first year. And then, yeah, third year.
That's exciting. That's fabulous. So it's too early to ship them now. When will you start shipping?
I ship in April.
Okay.
And that's so I can ensure that everyone's getting a healthy, viable tuber.
Oh, my goodness. So that we'll put the link to that tuber page on the show notes, because I think this, I love your prediction that you've got the next Cafe LA.
I hope.
But yeah, it's going to have to get into production to really
absolutely
make a splash. You're selling flowers in an unusual way, though, to local florists and into the wholesale market. And I think it's exciting. When I heard that you were selling in New York, I knew some designers were buying from you direct. But just the fact that the demand for unusual heirloom varieties and just locally grown flowers is in existence at all is just so encouraging. So
absolutely.
How is that going?
Well, it's going wonderfully. For our second year selling flowers, last season was fantastic. It's kind of a one-woman show at Meadowburn. I mentioned I have...
You're the one woman.
I'm the one woman. I have a part-time helper, and then I have interns. Whatever I cut and sell has to be really easy for me.
Sure.
But because we have this picking garden that was created for cut flowers, selling flowers to me is also a way of preserving that part of what the garden was for Helena Rutherford Ely. So it's in keeping with the intention of the picking garden. And then so for the peonies, for example, we're going to put the time in to cultivate them and make sure that they're beautiful and mildew-free no matter what. And so to spend the time cutting them and selling them is a pretty minimal investment on
sure.
our part. And everything I'm growing, I'm going to grow anyways.
Wow.
So I found a way to make it easy and trouble-free as much as possible. And the one caveat is that anyone who wants flowers has to come to me.
Yes.
And that's tricky because not everyone can, and it's not worth it for everybody.
But you've described to me of florists in the city, in Brooklyn or New York, renting a car, because nobody owns a car, right?
Mm-hmm.
Renting a car and driving out to Meadowburn to pick up buckets from you, and that that's actually more economical than buying from, in some cases, from a wholesaler in the city. So I guess where there's a will, there's a way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're not open for business. People need to make an appointment with you and get on your availability sheet, right?
Exactly, yeah. And often what happens is I'll receive an email from a florist that has a wedding coming up, and they send me kind of sometimes like a Pinterest board of their vision and, Quill, do you have any flowers coming up in this color scheme and what might be available? Sometimes I have just a very limited variety of a certain kind of foxglove that I'm not going to put on the availability list, but if someone's looking for, you know,
a dozen of them or something.
A dozen, yeah, then I might have it. And I think that's where it becomes worth it for the individual designers to come out if they're getting something at a small scale that they wouldn't be able to get
Absolutely.
In the market. So it's been really fun to work with florists on the personal level like that. But definitely what's easier and makes more of an impact for our business is working with the 28th Street Market, where they're able to send out a van once a week and load up with buckets. And
that's great.
Makes it pretty easy.
But they're basically taking whatever you harvest, and they know there'll be hungry buyers waiting for that stuff. I've heard that people get to 28th Street early and kind of duke it out for your flowers.
You have heard that?
Yes, I have. But that's only happening because that is a wholesaler who's willing to tell people that where these flowers were grown.
Absolutely.
And if that's adding to the value of serving the customer and also I'm thrilled that there's a concern about educating people where these flowers were actually grown. They're from New Jersey. They're from a historic, you know, garden, and they're grown by incredibly talented, you know, careful practices. So they're probably worth every penny.
Yeah, I think so. I think definitely so. And, you know, one of the things that works well about the wholesale relationship with this particular shop is partly the relationships that I've established with florists in the city through you, a lot of them, that I'm just connected with through social media. And I might, you know, we talked about Instagram earlier today, like send out a picture of the Foxglove that are going to be at 28th Street tomorrow.
Oh,
and,
cool.
They are, you know, familiar with me and Meadowburn, and then might make the extra trip to 28th Street just to get the Foxglove.
Wow.
So that's been wonderful.
Do you do any floral design yourself?
No. I used to.
You're like Helena. You just went all variety, all the same single variety in one vase. Right?
Yes. You know, it's funny because in high school, I worked at Blooms on Broadway in the Broadway Market.
Oh, yeah.
For years. And I loved designing with flowers. But I think now more than anything, it's just really enjoying providing other designers with the material and seeing them be excited about it is even more rewarding for me than doing it myself.
That's your creativity right there.
Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time. Before we go, I want to just highlight the fact that you're going to be giving this wonderful lecture at the winter lecture series that Wave Hill Gardens is producing starting next Wednesday, January 20th. I was so thrilled when I saw that I'm on their mailing list. I saw that you were going to be their first speaker of the season. And that the lecture's in New York City, not out in the Bronx, so maybe more people can get to it. It's called Finding My Way. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So I'll put the link to how people can buy tickets and hopefully come hear you. What do you think people are going to hear about finding your way? I love that title.
Well, when I was asked to do the talk, I said, oh, absolutely, I'll present on Helena Rutherford Ely and the history of Meadowburn. And I said, actually, we really want the talk to be about your personal experience interpreting Helena's vision and implementing it, and how you've approached that process, which is much harder presentation to give than the history. But
because it's so personal.
It's
right?
So personal. So I really had to figure out how to put my personal experience into words and images. And what I hope to convey to the audience is that, you know, this is my first job as a professional in garden preservation, and I came to it almost thinking that I was like, there was some like predetermined path that I could follow based on historic documentation and best practices. And as I spent more time in the garden and observing and watching and learning from the landscape, and really, I think, experiencing Meadowburn as Helena Rutherford Ely experienced it, which is living and breathing there every single day, and seeing the morning light and the mist and the setting sun, and kind of learning the patterns of the seasons, that probably the best... it took me a long time to learn that my role in the preservation process was really to use my own experience, an intimate experience of the landscape, to interpret her vision, and that it's almost taking Ely's vision, interpreting Ely's vision, and expressing it through my vision.
I love that.
And so that's how, it's been this like very personal process, and thinking always like, what would Ely do? And even if I can't do what she would do or know what she would do in this situation, what makes most sense to me based on my understanding of her philosophy?
Wow. I think that's going to inspire a lot of people because it's so much about the authentic experience and not just what you get out of books.
Yeah.
But what you're occupying and observing that garden 24/7, and you are channeling her. But with your own twist. That's really special.
Yeah, thanks.
I can't wait to get Meadowburn on my travel schedule so I can come visit you, hopefully this coming summer.
Oh, I hope so.
I would just love to, I've seen the photos and I just envy the fact that you're there every day, although I know how hard it is and how much work it is, but I'd love to come visit.
Well, end of May, early June is the most spectacular time to visit in the spring.
I wonder why. Those peonies, right?
Peonies and the iris border.
Right. You have bearded irises.
Yeah.
I've pulled a few photos from your website share.
Yeah.
Those were there too, right?
Those were there. All.
Oh my gosh.
Very old iris. So that's a great time to visit, or when the dahlias bloom, which is August, September, October.
That's wonderful. Quill, thank you so much for chatting with me, bringing me up to speed on what you're doing, and sharing the story of Meadowburn and heirloom cut flowers with our listeners. I know it's going to inspire a lot of people, and they'll want to come visit and hopefully buy your flowers.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
It's been great.
Thank you for joining me today. I hope you're inspired to check out Meadowburn Farm and its website and learn more about this important living artifact in America's gardening narrative. Find the link and lots of gorgeous flower photos at deborahprinzing.com in our show notes. Home gardeners and florists alike are now able to order heirloom dahlia tubers that are the offspring of ones grown by Helena Rutherford Ely at Meadowburn Farm in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Meadowburn Farm's sustainably grown fresh-cut flowers from the 130-year-old picking garden are available via wholesale to florists and markets. Peonies are available starting in May through July. Dahlias are available July through mid-October. Other flowers often available include foxglove, lily of the valley, iris, cornflower, ami, phlox, nicotiana, nigella, and an assortment of other unusual, rare, and unlikely cut flowers and foliage from the gardens, meadows, and woodlands there. Please contact Quill directly for bulk and wholesale orders. Florists are encouraged to join her weekly wholesale availability list. You can incorporate a bit of American garden history into your own arrangements and support the restoration of this amazing garden while you're at it. Send your name and email address confirming your interest in cut flower availability to Quill, that's Q-U-I-L-L, at meadowburnfarm.com. And I'll have that link at deborahprinzing.com. New York City florists can often find Meadowburn's flowers at 28th Street Wholesale Flowers in Manhattan. And by the way, if you're in the New York City area, you're invited to hear from Quill next Wednesday evening in a lecture she's giving entitled Finding My Way. It takes place from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, January 20th. This is the first in Wave Hill's 2016 Horticultural Lectures, a winter series hosted by the Friends of the Horticulture Committee and devoted to the subject of garden making and garden design and the meaning of our interactions with plants and the natural world. And Wave Hill is an amazing botanical garden and estate in the Bronx, and another important place to put on your bucket list to visit. The series of these three lectures continues February 17th with garden writer Marta McDowell, and on March 16th with Catherine Tracy, co-owner of Avant Gardens, a nationally known mail-order nursery and garden design build firm in Massachusetts. As you all may remember, she was the instigator of the Slow Flowers Challenge last year. All three talks are held at the New York School of Interior Design in Manhattan, and you can purchase the series tickets for $60 or $50 if you're a Wave Hill member or a student. Individual lecture tickets range between $25 and $20. Seating is limited and advanced reservations are recommended. And I've got all the details at deborahprinzing.com. One more piece of last-minute news. If you haven't heard, next week on January 18th, Ohio flower farmers are gathering in Cincinnati for their second annual meetup. You can find all the details on Buckeye Bloom's event page, where Susan Studer King and others have created an info-packed and inspiring program. The meeting will take place at Sunny Meadows Flower Farm outside of Cincinnati, thanks to hosts Steve and Gretel Adams. I'll be there in spirit via a Slow Flowers surprise package we're donating for a door prize. When I checked in with Susan earlier this week, she said that the registration is nearing capacity, but to get in touch if you're interested in attending, and I'll have those links at deborahprinzing.com. Susan said they may be able to squeeze in a couple late entrants. The Slow Flowers podcast has been downloaded more than 78,000 times by listeners like you. Thank you to each and every one of you for downloading, listening, commenting, and sharing. It means so much. Until next week, you're invited to join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time. And if you like what you hear, please consider logging onto iTunes and posting a listener review. The content and opinions expressed here are either mine alone or those of my guests alone, independent of any podcast sponsor or other person, company, or organization. The Slow Flowers Podcast is engineered and edited by Andrew Wheatley and Hannah Holdgertz. Learn more about their work at shellandtree.com.